Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today explores the way we care for ourselves when life throws us a loop, when we experience health issues or grief or sadness. Wintering is what fiction writer and memoirist Catherine May calls it, a withdrawal for a time, much akin to the way our ancestors naturally experience life during the winter. A hunkering down, if you will, something we've all been experiencing since last March. In May's case, it's something she's done periodically in life, the most recent episode in response to health crises in her and her husband's life. In Wintering, the power of rest and retreat during difficult times, May weaves lessons from mythology, science, literature, and nature, along with her own story, giving readers a guide into the seasonal withdrawal humans used to regularly experience. Catherine May is the author of several books, a mix of fiction and memoir, including The Electricity of Every Living Thing, The Whitstable High Tide Swimming Club, and Ghosts and Their Uses. Her journalism and essays have appeared in British newspapers and American magazines. Her latest book, Wintering, is published by Riverhead, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Catherine May, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell us a little bit what you mean by the term wintering.
Okay, so wintering is a time in your life when you fall through the cracks. So it could come from a range of different things. In fact, I wanted to join the dots between lots of different experiences that seem different, but which actually lead us to the same place. So it could come from physical illness, mental illness. It could come from a life event like a divorce or losing your job. It can come from external factors like global pandemics. We enter this space where we're thrown out of everyday life for a while and we're in pain. We're having a terrible time. And I wanted to talk about this as a very normal part of the human experience, as something that is a natural part of our life cycle, even though we tend to hide it because we feel so much shame about it. And I think that shame is misplaced. And I wanted to show how we can get better at wintering by actually engaging with it and asking what we're being shown in that time and seeing what change we've got to make.
Do you think it's sort of hardwired into our DNA? I mean, I would think prior to industrial life, most people did winter. I mean, when it was an agricultural life, when we were hunter-gatherers, we probably did slow down a great deal, at least seasonally.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think we used to have a very different rhythm to our year to what we understand now. I mean, all of those big festivals that happen in the winter will once have felt very necessary to keep us going. And of course, I mean, I live in a really temperate part of the UK. We're one of the warmest parts of the UK altogether. And I don't think anywhere in England really understands what it's like to truly endure those deep winters of the north. But loads of communities, and particularly in the US, will understand what it's like to be snowed in, to actually have winter cut you off. And there's a real skill set around handling that time that once would have been very familiar to all of us, but now seems almost niche to so many people.
But what you're talking about, though, in this book really is may coincide with winter, but it's more a withdrawal due to coping with crisis, with depression, with sadness, those sorts of things.
Yeah, what I wanted to say was that we can draw on how people who are intimate with those wintry, those true deep winters, we can draw on how they cope with them in order to learn a lot ourselves about how to deal with personal crises. And so I interview quite a lot of people from Scandinavian countries, from Finland, Sweden, Iceland, Norway, and ask them how they coped with their deep winters. And they explain to me that they don't love them. You know, there's loads that they hate about the snow and how it comes and takes over their life. But they have got ways through. And there's bits of it that they find very beautiful and very wonderful. But the awful bits they endure because they create great space inside their home, they create great family time, and they prepare really hard to make sure that when their winter comes, they are absolutely ready for it.
There's a section of the book where you visit, I guess, some part of Scandinavia, and you learn about sauna culture. You know, you have such a precise way with language. You said, you know, it's very interesting. I heard people not say, I'm not going into the sauna, I'm in sauna. And and you had your own experience with sauna as well. So, and this is a big part of the book, is you sort of go out and experience these things that you're you're writing about. What was your experience like, and what do you think people get from that sauna culture?
Yeah, so the Finns, I mean, they would have a sauna in their house as commonly as you'd have a bathroom, almost. It's just something that they see as an absolute winter essential if you live in the north. And the woman I interviewed, Hannah Malinen, told me about the state of mind, which is in sauna. It's, you know, it's a sauna state of mind. It's calm, it's contemplative, it's kind of very contented, very cozy. And they said that, you know, traditionally you would have given birth in the sauna. You would have taken your dead into the sauna to wash the body. Like, everything happened there. It's this real place of almost ritual significance. And so we use the sauna in England like as a, you know, leisure activity. But I am not very good with heat. And so when I tried to endure my winter in the sauna, I ended up fainting on the floor of a leisure centre and had to have the whole crew come and rescue me semi-naked. And they came running with, like, defibrillators and all these. Yeah, it was awful. It was an absolute nightmare. I'm never doing that again.
Well, let's take a step back. What precipitated your own bout of wintering? You're very frank about this in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. So mine began really when my husband very suddenly developed a really severe appendicitis, which even after it had been operated on, he was very sick for quite a long time. And during that time, I realized, I think it almost opened up a time when I could think about my own body and how it was doing. And I realized that I'd had an illness rumbling for a long time. I was having problems with my abdominal region in general, really. And I became very ill myself. And that happened at the same time that I was already in the process of leaving my, like, very stressful, busy job in a university. And I think it almost accelerated me leaving. So while I was serving out my notice, I then got signed off sick. And so I found myself in this situation where I felt really isolated from my colleagues, wondering what they were thinking of me, you know, assuming that they must have thought that I was deliberately skiving work because I didn't want to be there anymore, and wondering what would happen with my health, wondering what would happen with our family, like feeling this really close sense of our mortality as we began to get older. And it was a very particular time. I was already writing the book by then. I hadn't really meant for all that to happen while I was writing the book. I'd meant to look over my past winterings and draw some, you know, wise conclusions from it. But I found myself actually writing a blow-by-blow account of what it was like to live through that very specific moment. And it changed the book immeasurably because I think it brought it closer almost.
This book very much is a literary attempt to understand wintering. It's best to be read in a short burst. An essay on metamorphosis might look at how nature prepares for winter, giving way to, you know, from a life to dormancy. And all of a sudden, we're talking about your own life as your life is changing in your dietary regime to your abdominal illness. And all of a sudden, you're eating all the foods that most of us crave that you've never enjoyed and feeling guilty for it. I find that very unfair.
I know. I'm so sorry. If it's any consolation, I miss aubergines really badly. Like, they were my favorite food and I cannot eat them anymore. They're really terrible for me.
But the idea of the book is sort of a personal as well as, you know, issues of nature, of science and your exploration. And it's sort of, I mean, these are very literary essays, and this is what you tried to do in the book.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I try and marry all of the different aspects that come up for me. So, yeah, there's a literary angle, there's a nature writing angle, there's a aspect of memoir. I'm really interested in folklore as well. So it's a collision of all those things. And it's really interesting that you say it's a book to be savoured, because it seems to be half and half. Half of my readers seem to read it in one great big gulp and tell me they sat up all night to finish it. And the other half say, oh, I'm reading it chapter by chapter and I'm going to try and follow through the seasons with it. It takes people in different ways, which is so interesting as a writer, just to see how people use your book once it gets out there and it's out of your control.
Now, in the book, again, there's these wonderful little sort of sidebar journeys, and you introduced me to a word I never knew, and it was the Oxford Word of the Year in 2016. It's called, I think it's called Hyg. It's a Danish word, H-Y-G-G-E. Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
Hyg?
No, but it took me a long time to learn it. It's hygge.
Hygge.
That's the best I can do. Probably one of your listeners will now ring in and say, no, it's not. But yeah, we pronounce it Hygge.
Okay, so Hygge. So what does this word mean, and how does this work in regard to wintering?
So Hygge is a word that expresses the retreat into the home during the winter and the practice of making your home a cozy, welcoming space. But it's not, the word doesn't refer to the home itself. It responds to your feeling as that's happening. So it's coziness, I guess, is a very basic translation of it. But it's a beautiful word. So it's all about lighting fires, lighting candles, creating a really warm environment where you're sheltering from the worst ravages of the winter.
Mm. And is this sort of the experience you had during these wintering episodes that you've had in your life?
Definitely. I mean, for me, that's one of the true pleasures of winter. I mean, I'm not a big summer fan. I spend all the year gazing longingly at my jumpers because I can't wait to get back into nice coats. Sorry, I shouldn't say jumpers in America because that's a dress,
right.
Isn't it? Sweaters. I'm gradually learning that. I look at my cashmere in my wardrobe and just gaze at it. But also, I learned to bring light into the house in the way that the Scandinavians do, you know, to put candles in every dark corner, to hang string lights up, to have that lovely twinkly feeling in the house, to light lamps, just to do anything to make sure that you're bringing deliberate happiness, deliberate coziness, deliberate comfort during the times when you're suffering, rather than deliberately trying to make it as hard as possible because you don't feel like you're worth it. You don't feel like you deserve that comfort.
My guest today is Catherine May, fiction writer and memoirist. Her latest book is titled Wintering, The Power of Rest and Retreat During Difficult Times. It's published by Riverhead. And of course, we are all going to some degree or another a phase of wintering around the world and certainly in the U.S. these days with the pandemic. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You said you do love the cold. You write in moments of helplessness. You love to travel north to the cold. Why is that?
I wish I could understand it because I come from a family of absolute sun seekers. My mother and my grandparents were all big sunbathers. I look very different to them. I'm very pale, so I don't think I've ever been able to cope with the sun. And so I think it's only in the winter that I really feel comfortable and at home. But I'm just in love with that northern landscape and what the cold does to it. I love seeing snow. I love seeing ice and frost. And I love getting into really cold seas too. So I don't know. I'm drawn to the north always. Iceland, Norway, all of those places are just my favorites.
And of course, during the course of the book, you do go to Iceland. You go see the northern lights or you write about seeing the northern lights in Norway. Mm. You go visit the Blue Lagoon. You revel in these experiences. Why share these experiences in the course of this book?
I think they're really instructive. I think they show us how there's a different way to endure the winter to the way that we certainly do it in the UK, which is to hide behind our front doors quite often and to pretend it's not happening. When I went to Norway, I was quite heavily pregnant already, and I completely shocked my midwife by having this complete desire to travel to somewhere really, really cold. But what I saw there was people coping in such a different way that was really allied with the landscape. And so whereas we, you know, try not to take babies outside during the winter, for example, in Norway they were being pushed around in prams stacked up with feather quilts. You know, like they'd have six or seven quilts stacked on top of them to keep them warm. But everyone was going out there and coping and enjoying it and taking pleasure in the season. And I really think that that's so instructive for us, that the outside world doesn't become cut off when winter comes. It actually just becomes a very different landscape to explore and to really enjoy.
Another part of the book deals with sleep, the traditions of sleep prior to modern life. You describe something called first sleep and morning sleep. And during this pandemic, this is the one term I've heard so many people talk about, how their sleep has been disrupted. I refer to it as waking up at 3 to 4 in the morning with a monkey mind, you know, a mind that just won't quit working. And I think this is something that all of us have been experiencing, especially during this pandemic. We probably experience it all the time, but we deal with it better. And now during the pandemic, I just find it almost a universal comment of people having their sleep patterns disturbed. You spend quite a bit of book talking about sleep.
Yeah, I find sleep really interesting. I mean, I've never been a great sleeper in modern terms. You know, I've never been able to sleep through the night, really. But in the course of the book, I looked into how people used to sleep in the winter in pre-industrial times. So before we had electric light everywhere and clocks in every house, and you know, certainly before we had apps monitoring exactly how long we sleep for every night and giving us a report about whether we've done well enough. And what I discovered was that it was really normal for people to sleep in two shifts during those periods. I mean, and that's for most of human history. So people would go to bed and have a first sleep that would last about 4 hours, wake up at that 2 or 3 in the morning that is so familiar to all of us. And that period was called the watch. So it was a distinct period of the night where you didn't expect to be sleeping, where you expected to be awake. And it was special because it was a time when you were alone with your family. Everyone was probably awake at the same time, but it wasn't a time when you would mix with people on the outside, you know. So it was a time when people often said they prayed, they had light conversation, they contemplated or meditated. They often smoked in later times, which I kind of loved. And they also often had sex. So it became this, yeah, because nobody was going to bother them.
Oh, right.
But it was this distinct time. And then they went back to sleep again for 4 hours. And the difference is that they didn't worry about it. It seemed like absolutely normal sleep to them. And so they didn't call it insomnia. And it was actually a pleasant time that was an extra couple of hours in their days rather than a time when they'd screwed up and woken up somehow.
Interesting. And you found that during this wintering, you began to embrace your own insomnia.
Yeah. So I, ever since really researching the book, have embraced having a wake in the night. And it's such a different moment. I love it now. If I wake up in the night, I get up, I read, I do something very light. You know, I don't use a screen. I don't get on my phone. I don't check Twitter. I don't put the TV on. But I might read or write in my notebook. I might meditate. Sometimes I bake, which I think is like probably the craziest thing I do in the middle of the night. But actually, there's a routine to it. You know, I'm awake for 2 hours and then I'm tired and I go to sleep again. I do go to bed very early, so I kind of make the time for it. But I find that I'm disappointed now if I don't wake up in the night. I feel like I've lost what feels to me like a really special time. And there was some research that was done a few years ago into what would happen if you took electric light away from modern people. And very quickly, they dropped into this rhythm of a first and a second sleep divided by wakefulness in between. But when they tested people's blood during that period of wakefulness, they found that it had a really particular hormonal mix, which we don't see in the rest of life. So people had very high levels of prolactin in their blood, which is the hormone normally only found in breastfeeding mothers. So whether they were male or female, those people who were awake in the middle of the night were in a very particular state of mind, which they described as dreamy, contemplative, but actually feeling very comfortable and happy and able to reflect on life in a way that they didn't feel like for the rest of the time. And I found that as soon as I stopped worrying about my insomnia, in inverted commas, that I adopted that mindset too, that it didn't feel like monkey mind anymore because I wasn't fighting it and I wasn't wondering why the hell I was awake. And instead, it just feels very calm and very lovely, and I really value it.
You know, this is the big issue, is that so many people are depending on that 6 or 7 hours of sleep in a single stretch because their lives are so, you know, you have to get up in the morning, you have to go to work, and how do you disconnect from some of that?
Well, that's a huge question, isn't it? I mean, our whole lives are made around a certain timetable these days, and I do go to bed much earlier than most people. But the process of writing the book for me was one of huge change and gradually trying to de-busy my life, I suppose. I mean, one of the conclusions that I drew while writing the book was that I had this fear of not looking busy to the outside world. You know, I didn't want people to think that I wasn't important and that I wasn't having to rush around because I was so in demand. And I think we're all a little bit addicted to that. So slowly, I've gradually tried to cut more and more out of my life, really. And that makes more space for lovely things like sleep. I do love sleeping. I think I love it more than most people. It does make me very, very happy. I don't cope very well without it either, I have to say. But you know, I think we can adjust to more comfortable ways of life, but it is a huge adjustment and it takes huge change and commitment if we want to make it.
That fear of not looking busy or the fear of missing out is so big in our culture today.
And I mean, I don't know about you, but so often if I bump into someone in the street and they say, "Oh, how are you?" My first instinct is, "Oh yeah, busy. And I think it's a kind of disease. Like, I'm trying to train myself to say, "Oh, actually, I haven't got much on at the moment. It's really nice." But that's so hard. I mean, our egos get in the way of that. And we know that people will think less of us when we say that. We've really become a society that is in such a hurry all the time. And that would be fine if it wasn't taking such a toll on our health, but it is taking a toll on our health, not just mine. I mean, I know that it certainly affected my health being crazy, crazy busy all the time. But we are suffering mentally and physically from not taking a rest and not ever cutting ourselves off from the world for a while and not following that natural rhythm of the seasons that once would have made us cut off for a little while.
My guest today is Catherine May, fiction writer and memoirist. Her new book is titled Wintering, The Power of Rest and Retreat During Difficult Times. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You try to understand this idea, and you go to several midwinter festivals, or actually they're the beginning of winter festivals, if you really want to be put a fine point on it. You spent the winter solstice at Stonehenge, and I imagine that was an interesting experience.
Yeah, it's something I'd always wanted to do, actually. I mean, Stonehenge is such an iconic structure in the UK, and I pass it every year when I drive down to Cornwall for my holiday. But it's actually been a very contested festival. So it happens exactly at midwinter, at exactly the point when the shortest day turns into the beginning of the day's lengthening again. And Stonehenge itself was set up to showcase the sun as it rose that next morning and as it set the night before. That's the exact alignment of it, and it only comes into line at the winter and summer solstices. So I made the journey down there, left the house at 4 o'clock in the morning with my friend Becky and our two children. And we witnessed what was a really fascinating festival of loads of different beliefs coming together. You know, there was no one group there that was claiming their right to be at Stonehenge at midwinter. There were Wiccans, there were Druids, there were people who I don't think represented any particular religion. But they were all there to have this sense of celebration at the turn of the year. And it was actually really beautiful. There was singing, there was drumming, there was music everywhere. But more than that, there was this sense of community and collective excitement. I'm so glad I saw it. I wouldn't have missed it. I'd love to go back this year, but I don't think it will be on, sadly.
Yeah. One of the things you write about is when people are asked to cope with crisis, we're told to keep our chin up, power through. He says, you write that feels like denial. Unhappiness and sadness, I guess, are parts of our life to embrace just as we do joy and contentment. That's a hard thing to do. How have you learned to do that in your own life?
Well, it's a long, slow process. I mean, I think that those feelings, you know, sadness, grief, anomie, they're really basic emotions for us. They're something that we all feel automatically, but we try to pretend that we don't. We try to find ways not to talk about them. And if you actually spend some time with them, you know, if you let the other things in your life fall away and open up time, open up moments when you're on your own, you know, walking or cooking in your kitchen or whatever it is, and you're not doing anything else other than being in your head, you start to feel the purity of those emotions. And they're not pleasant, but there's a beauty to them and there's a necessity to them that I think we've missed. And I think actually re-engaging with them, and, you know, that can be through working with a therapist, for example. I mean, I think a lot of the time when people are in therapy, what they're learning to do is work their way back to feeling the purity of those feelings. But it's when we keep pushing them away that we really suffer, I think. There's a kind of flinch that we feel when our mind is approaching those feelings and we can't go there, we can't let ourselves go there. And I think that's when we become incredibly stressed and anxious. And I know I've suffered from that so much in my life, and I probably will again. But I really have found huge, huge comfort, weirdly, in letting myself feel sad sometimes and letting myself feel desolate and lonely and hopeless. One of the things that comes up is that those feelings are surprisingly fleeting when you actually look them in the eye.
That's a good way to think about it. One last question, and that is, we're now at a time when some of us have wintered for going on 8 months due to the pandemic. And I think you just have to look at what's happened in the United States to know that many Americans have not done well with this. It's been very difficult and extremely difficult. And almost, I think a lot of people believe it's just not in our nature to hunker down like this for so long. As we approach real winter in a pandemic, do you have any advice for us?
Yeah, I mean, we're in exactly the same situation. And I think actually so far, we've been very lucky that this has been happening through spring and summer. That's made it easier. We've been able to get outside. I mean, in the UK, we've actually had one of the warmest years on record. And normally I'd be worrying about that. But in fact, it's been a gift this year. As we move towards winter, I think we have to keep refreshing our commitment to surviving this. And when I say surviving this, I don't mean surviving it in the rawest terms possible. I mean giving ourselves permission to squeeze all the joy we possibly can out of this life within the restrictions we're living with. I've heard a lot of people telling each other off for cracking jokes and making light or saying that actually, you know, they've enjoyed aspects of the pandemic. And I'd say completely the opposite, that actually it's part of our survival instinct to make the best of it we can. And there'll be moments when that doesn't work and when we really are struggling and suffering. But that doesn't mean to say that we can't burrow into the rest of the time the best we can and to make our homes a happy place, to deliberately entertain ourselves, to find opportunities to laugh, to get outdoors as much as we possibly can, to keep moving, to keep exercising, to encounter the movement of daylight through the day, you know, like reject artificial light as much as you can and be there for the sun rising and setting, like make the most of that time. And even to feel the actual cold, like all of that stuff is instructing our bodies in a way that we evolve to understand the seasons. And I think the more we can engage with that, the better we'll come out of this. But, you know, I am making plans for Christmas that I wouldn't normally be bothering making this year. I am cooking so many different foods already because I don't know if we'll be able to see any family. And I haven't seen my mum for the best part of the year. But I'm just going to have the best time we possibly can, given the restrictions we're in. That's all I can do. But I think it's the least we can do as well.
I think we've set an all-time record for holiday lights being up in homes around around our city. And I think everybody is wishing for it. And I wish you a very pleasant holiday season. And thank you so much for your time, Catherine.
Thank you so much.
Catherine May is the author of Wintering, The Power of Rest and Retreat During Difficult Times. It's published by Riverhead Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks so much for listening. Be safe.